From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. New numbers from the State Department of Public Instruction help tell the story of student performance in North Carolina's public schools. We'll seek an expert's help making sense of those numbers. The State Historical Commission recently rejected a proposal to remove Confederate monuments from the state capitol grounds. You'll hear highlights from a debate on the topic. You'll also hear competing perspectives about the future of UNC Chapel Hill's Silent Sam statue. Plus, we'll highlight a new group set up to investigate $58 million connected to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Those topics are just ahead, but first, a look back at some of the history of this program, Carolina Journal Radio. The following words marked a new era in North Carolina radio.
This week from Carolina Journal, another big hole in North Carolina's state budget.
That's the voice of John Locke Foundation President John Hood announcing the launch of this program, Carolina Journal Radio, more than 15 years ago. Hood is now the Locke Foundation's chairman, and the organization has seen other changes. One constant, Carolina Journal Radio, now marking its 800th weekly episode. Let's review some highlights.
When you look at the great crises, we found that it was government policy that brought about the crisis, and in each case, the private sector, free markets get the blame.
That's Forbes Media CEO and former Republican presidential candidate Steve Forbes, who's made more than one visit to Carolina Journal Radio.
I think the American people realize that Washington's program of binge spending, raising taxes, trying to take over health care is not the way we're going to get our country on a good growth path in the future.
Forbes is one of many Carolina Journal Radio guests who have touted the value of America's system of free enterprise. Another, American Enterprise Institute President Arthur Brooks.
The road to freedom is effectively free enterprise. The road to freedom as a society is free enterprise. And the reason I say this is in response to a common mistake that people make in the conservative movement. Understanding free enterprise is nothing more than an economic alternative. It's not an economic alternative, it's a moral imperative.
An overly meddlesome federal government can stand in the way of economic growth. Libertarian economist Walter Williams warned us that state governments can impede growth as well.
Many state governments make a very difficult environment for businessmen to operate in. They have this law that regulates their activities. They have all kinds of taxes. For North Carolina, if I were the governor, I would eliminate those disincentives for businessmen to come in.
Several guests have focused on the important role America's 40th president played in our nation's history. Peggy Noonan wrote speeches for Ronald Reagan.
He knew how to persuade. He knew how to bring people along with him. But he didn't put the bully in the bully pulpit. You know, he was not much of a bully. But the biggest thing about him, of course, was that he had a very special kind of political courage, and it was the political courage of one who swims against the tide.
Ramesh Panuru of National Review discussed Ronald Reagan's relevance today.
We stick to those old principles and apply them to new circumstances, and that's, in fact, what Reagan did. You know, he didn't just run on Barry Goldwater's campaign platform of 1964. He looked around, saw that there was a different world, there were different challenges, Americans wanted different things, and he didn't really deviate from conservative principles, but he had practical solutions to the challenges of that time.
Speaking of presidents, multiple guests have discussed the impact of our 44th president. That includes syndicated columnist Cal Thomas.
A lot of people are calling it socialism. I don't know what you would call it, but it's certainly being done without the permission of the public. We don't elect dictators in this country. The best advances are done by consensus and by bringing the public along.
Author and columnist Jonah Goldberg raised concerns about efforts to stifle dissent from Barack Obama's policy proposals.
This quest for unity, this quest for silencing dissent, it is in that climate
that history's greatest mistakes and crimes are made. And regardless of whether or not you agree with Obama's rhetoric or Obama's program or agenda, let's keep in mind that, you know, I don't think dissent is the highest form of patriotism, but I think it's really scary that now we're hearing that dissent is the lowest form of racism.
Fred Barnes of Fox News and the Weekly Standard says re-election allowed Barack Obama to reveal more of his left-wing ideology.
He's talking about raising taxes, particularly raising taxes on the wealthy. President Obama, of course, doesn't seem to care whether that will have an adverse effect on the economy, which it certainly would. This is just something he wants to do.
Columnist DeRoy Murdoch panned the president's signature piece of legislation.
I don't think the advocates of Obamacare have thought through this proposal at all. I don't think they've thought about the unintended consequences. I think they're really living in a fantasy land where they think they can bring 30 million people into the system who are not in, offer them coverage, and have costs go down rather than up. I mean, this is a basic abrogation of the entire concept of supply and demand.
Andrew McCarthy of National Review raised questions about federal law enforcement agencies' different treatment of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
Every person, whether he's the president or the lowliest person, is supposed to be equal, not only before the bar of justice, but also how they are regarded by the federal and the other police and intelligence agencies. And when we see that, you know, if you're one particular stripe of person, you get one quality of justice, and that everybody else gets a quite different quality of justice, I think that's very alarming to people. And it should be.
TV host John Stossel made the case for libertarian policies, including a more market-based approach to pharmaceutical regulations.
Well, we're going to approve this new heart drug, and it'll save 14,000 American lives a year. And all the reporters said, great. But it takes 10 years and $1 billion to get a drug approved. So if they're saving 14,000 this year with the new drug, didn't that mean they killed 14,000 people last year and the year before that, back 10 years? It did mean that.
Charles Cook of National Review spelled out a conservatarian approach to public policy.
How can we move forward on the right and try to accommodate all of the various factions, not just libertarians and conservatives, but younger conservatives and older conservatives as well? And I hope what I've done is given a blueprint, a roadmap for that, that also works, doubles perhaps, as a roadmap for how to fix a divided country.
Conservative television analyst Mary Catherine Hamm explained why she fights efforts to shut down political debate.
There do seem to be a lot more topics that are off limits or scary to talk about, or you're sort of walking on eggshells. And even more concerning than that is, like, you know, we're public figures. We take on some language policing as part of our jobs. But just regular people are feeling this, sort of becoming pariahs, being called racists or homophobes or whatever the ism of the day is, just for expressing a political position on Facebook. And we felt like maybe this is not the America we want to live in.
Author Virginia Pastrell highlighted the role of glamour in politics.
The thing about glamour is it always contains an element of illusion. It hides costs. It hides details. It hides distractions. It gives you, you know, the picture that you want to project yourself into and think, if life could only be like that. And that can be very inspiring. It can be very positive in an individual's life. But when you bring it into the public policy sphere, it often hides the details that actually are going to be what it's like to experience that policy.
Scholar Charles Murray highlighted the negative impact of the collapse of marriage among low-income Americans.
That's a stunningly large divergence between classes in just 50 years, because we're talking about the central cultural institution. When marriage changes, everything changes. That has meant, among other things, social capital collapses, behavior of men changes, because we also know, social scientists have demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt, that marriage civilizes men.
In addition to the big issues of the day, Carolina Journal Radio has explored history. Satirist P.J. O'Rourke discussed Adam Smith's classic economics text, The Wealth of Nations.
His fundamental theory of free markets has to do with individual liberty and property rights. He's starting with our right to ourself, our right to our own self-possession, our right to be free people.
Philosopher Michael Novak discussed the founder's emphasis on American virtue.
You cannot have a republic, a special form of government, without liberty. And you cannot have liberty without virtue. That is, if people don't have really good habits of taking responsibility for their actions, thinking about the consequences, taking responsibility for their own destiny. If they can't do that, how can they practice self-government?
Princeton professor Robert George emphasized civic virtue.
If all we had to rely on were the formal mechanics of the Constitution, our liberty would pretty quickly disappear. It takes a certain kind of people, a certain kind of culture, a certain kind of civic culture, in which people exercise and exhibit a certain kind of virtue to make liberty actually flourish.
Carolina Journal Radio has highlighted hundreds of interviews over the years. We look forward to many more. We'll return with another new interview in just a moment. Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Are North Carolina school kids learning what they need to? That is the heart of the discussion that's now underway following the release of new state test scores and accountability measures. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He has been analyzing the data and joins us now to talk about all of that. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, your general impression. What is the headline for you out of all of this new data?
Well, there hasn't been much improvement in the metrics that we use to measure student performance, and that includes graduation rates, rates of growth, year-to-year growth, and proficiency rates. We've seen some incremental changes over the last 5 years, but really the story is the same as it was last year in that students don't seem to be doing better on state tests or graduating at greater rates than they did in previous years.
Have we essentially reached a plateau in this state where we're just not able to really budge one way or another?
It seems that way. And we've not only plateaued overall, but we've plateaued in our subject areas, especially the ones that we test the most, which is reading and math. And those, of course, are the areas that we want to see some progress in because we've been investing quite a bit of money in especially reading instruction. So those two areas in particular, we're not seeing the type of growth that we really need to. And considering the investments that we've made, we would, according to those who believe that more money helps, start to see some payoff.
Talk a little bit more, if you would, about reading and math and what we are seeing. Is it declines that we're seeing?
We're not seeing declines necessarily. If you look at the five-year trend, for example, in math, we've seen about a 5 percentage point increase in proficiency. But in reading, only a 1 percentage point increase in proficiency over the last 5 years. So we're seeing very incremental growth, and it's not really meaningful when you look at it because, you know, those are probably just variations that we see year to year and not really the kind of growth that we would expect or we would hope to see in our test scores. And most concerning is the test score growth in grades 3 through 8 because these are the really the lay the foundations for literacy and math skills, and we're not seeing growth in those grades in reading and reading and math as well.
Terry, as I was reading through your analysis of this, which is available at johnlocke.org, there were a couple of data points and analyses from you that really just jumped out at me, and I want to talk about those a bit. You write this: simply put, around half of North Carolina students are not on track to be prepared to further their education or enter the workforce after graduation. Now, to me, that's pretty stunning, particularly since at the top line number on graduation in North Carolina is pretty darn high.
That's right. We've seen an 18 percentage point increase in graduation rate since 2006. So you would assume that we've made such great progress in graduation rates that we're graduating even better folks than we have. But there's really no indication that that's the case. We're still seeing students who graduate that continue to struggle, whether it be in college or career. The half that are career and college ready, which is what the state uses for those who achieve levels 4 and 5 on our 5-tier system, are the ones that, of course, score the highest on the state tests, but also the ones that have the skills that are necessary to be successful. And we're not seeing much growth in that area. And this year, we hit 49% in the college and career ready overall. That's the number really we should be aiming to increase, because while grade level proficiency, which is called level 3, is important, we should make sure that students really are prepared for what comes after graduation.
You also did a little bit of digging into what are termed the subgroups, and essentially the different demographics of the kids. They're sliced and diced different ways, mm-hmm. in terms of data. And you write this, shockingly, only 39.7% of black students in elementary and middle school grades are proficient in reading, and 36.5% are proficient in math. That's terrible. We should be so concerned about that.
We absolutely should be. It's appalling, and it has been that way for a very long time, for decades, in fact. And the fact that we see so few news stories about it and so few people speaking up about the fact that these students are falling way behind. When you're getting in a situation where roughly 4 out of every 10 African-American students just hits grade level proficiency, we're not even talking about career and college readiness, then there is a crisis on hand, and a crisis that we need to address immediately. Unfortunately, we don't see that kind of urgency either from the media or from elected officials in addressing these huge achievement gaps. The truth is that they've existed for a very long time. They're not going to be easy to close. But the first thing that we need to do is to admit that they exist. And judging from what we've seen in the media these last 24 hours after the test scores were released, there doesn't seem to be any urgency in addressing this issue.
What is it that we aren't doing? We know we've had a huge focus on money and per pupil funding over the last several years, a huge public discussion and General Assembly involved, budget people involved, and there has been an increase in spending on K-12 education. But clearly, money's not the number one answer here. It's part of the answer, as you have written about many times, but what do we need to do?
Well, we need to get the best teachers in front of these children, and that's easier said than done, obviously, but part of the answer is making sure that we get the very best teachers in low-income and low-performing schools, and that may require some financial incentives and other incentives to make sure that we get great educators in these areas. But I think we also need to offer these kids choice. A lot of the schools that they attend have been failing for a very long time. And sometimes just a change in scenery will make vast improvements in student performance for students that are stuck in failing schools. So if we can't get the kind of educators we need in the district schools that these children attend, let's give them a choice to go to a charter school, a private school, whatever school best meets their needs. Let's think about what their needs are first rather than the demands of the system.
We've talked about a number of these very challenging data points here, but there is a lot of data in this report, and I know that you've looked at much of it. For you, what is the bright spot in the data that's coming out about the last year?
For me, it's charter school performance. For years, charter schools lagged behind their district counterparts when it came to student performance, and we heard it every year in the media that charter schools are falling behind. Well, approximately 6 or 7 years ago, charter schools started outperforming school districts, and now we see that this trend has continued. There are more A and B schools, school performance grades, than there are in charter schools than there are in district schools. And There are fewer C and D schools in charters than districts. So when you look at how we grade schools, we find that charter schools are outperforming their district counterparts. And that's a story that needs to be told.
You can start understanding exactly what's going on here with our students in North Carolina by reading Dr. Terry Stoops' piece on this. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of the hottest topics in North Carolina politics in recent months involves the fate of Confederate monuments. The State Historical Commission recently weighed in. It addressed the future of Confederate monuments at the state capitol. Chris Fonville is a history professor at UNC Wilmington.
The past is often good, but sometimes bad and ugly. We cannot alter or change history or right past wrongs and injustices by attempting to erase it or topple or relocate its symbols. We should study history to remind us, teach us, guide us, and inspire us to be better persons and better citizens. By my calculations, based on the comments posted on the public portal on the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources website, and comments made to the Confederate Monument Study Committee during its public forum in March 2018, more than 80% of North Carolinians are not in favor of relocating the three Confederate monuments. Clearly, the statues and memorials hold different meanings to different people, despite the fact that no one living today condones slavery while readily conceding the evil, cruel, and inhumane bondage system that denied African Americans their freedom and agency. For some, they may represent the sacrifice of ancestors who were killed or died in the war. For others, the Southern soldiers' sense of duty to family and state, however, misguided the cause for which they fought, at least indirectly, that is, to maintain slavery.
Fonville voted to keep state capitol monuments in place. Voting to move them, Valerie Johnson, professor of women's studies at Bennett College.
The issue of Confederate monuments on the North Carolina state capitol grounds is actually a question of identity. We have an opportunity to reshape and reframe how we understand ourselves as North Carolinians. This is not erasure, but an act of revelation. An act of using the absence of these monuments to create a more accurate statement regarding North Carolina and her constituents. It is reimagining citizenship in a more truthful and inclusive way. At the center of the Civil War was the continued enslavement of African people. As such, the monuments represent the commitment of North Carolina to uphold the Confederacy. These monuments are a continual visual presence of the ideology of white supremacy. They are really memorials, more appropriate to a cemetery space or in a museum if the museum contextualizes them appropriately.
You've been listening to highlights from the North Carolina Historical Commission's recent debate about the future of Confederate monuments on the state capitol grounds. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of the hottest topics in North Carolina political news involves the fate of the toppled Silent Sam Monument at the UNC Chapel Hill campus. The UNC Systems Board has ordered the campus to come up with a plan for dealing with that monument by November 15th. Shortly after that announcement, Chancellor Carol Folt addressed reporters.
We're grateful for the support of the Board of Governors, Chair Harry Smith, and President Margaret Spellings on a proposal to develop and provide a plan for the future of the Confederate monument to the board by November 15, 2018. In their resolution, they, one, recognize that we have been, the Board of Trustees and the leadership team have been engaged in considerable work to explore options regarding the Confederate monument. And they go on to also say, and we agree, that we expect to be in a position to provide a plan for a lawful and lasting path that protects public safety, preserves the monument and its history, and allows the university to focus on its core mission of education, research, economic stimulation, and creating the next generation of leaders.
Folt says the university is considering its options.
We will look at all options, including one that features a location on campus to display the monument in a place of prominence, honor, visibility, availability, and access, where we can ensure public safety, ensure the monument's preservation and place in the history of UNC and the nation, while also following appropriate processes to secure any needed approvals from the Board of Trustees, the Board of Governors, the North Carolina Historical Commission, and or the North Carolina General Assembly.
Does Folt worry about the danger of protesters continuing to surround the site that once housed the monument?
I said from the start that I think safety is a paramount issue, and I think we're going to be working on that. What we're going to do is consider all those options, and as we make a plan that considers risk and longevity, and I think we are in a very a time when public safety is on my mind every minute of the day. So this gives us a chance to identify a plan that can be a legal solution, which allows us to have a safe and productive campus.
What does Folt think about the university system's order for a November 15th plan?
Right now I'm dealing with their resolution, and I think we have the opportunity and time to make a plan that we believe can be lawful and achievable. So I'm focusing on that right now.
What are some of the options UNC might explore if Silent Sam doesn't return to its old spot?
Well, I have to tell you that since I just got the resolution about 10 minutes ago, I'm not ready to give you an answer. We have been looking at things for a long time, considering all sorts of options. So I think we'll start moving pretty quickly, but I do think it's a bit, it wouldn't be thoughtful for me to start speculating on it within just minutes of having a chance to think about it. But we'll certainly be out there talking to people and I think looking for all that kind of resolution.
What are UNC Chancellor Carol Folt's priorities as this issue moves forward?
I have two major missions. We've got a great university that's going right now. We have hospitals. We have students coming in and on campus. And so we have to always be very mindful that we're keeping all that going and safe. And at the same time, we have to be really directing our efforts towards providing safety. So I do think that our police have already begun working with all the partners that they normally work with. There are resolution agreements that bring officers from around the state to assist. They are well underway at considering that, and I do really think they will do everything necessary to keep the peace at that moment and keep us going forward. Those are the two things that we have to really be mindful of, and then we get to that plan and we get to the other things that we need to do to make this all work.
Some critics have complained that UNC has taken too long to resolve this issue. Folt's response?
I'm always sympathetic of people that want things done faster. That is the era we're in. But in the end, I'm going to do it in a lawful way that is sustainable. And sometimes that doesn't get done as quickly as people like. So I tend to respect all that voice and concern. But I'm still very, very focused on the safety, on keeping the university going, and really meeting the desires of this plan. And I think, you know, that's what we have to do.
What's the message the chancellor sends to supporters and critics of the Silent Sam Monument?
Well, I think we'll do what we've done in the past, is try to give our community a picture of what's happening and how we're trying to handle it. I try very hard to tell students, because I believe this, I believe in free speech, I believe in the right for protest, but I also believe in safety first. So I think as we assess it, we're going to do our best to keep the emotion out of it and the facts in it. So that's how we'll try to deal with each one of these protests. My job is to hold those rights and have safety at the same time. So in the past, if we were concerned, we've asked people, we've suggested that they stay away because it may be difficult, but we've also said you can exercise your rights and we'll do our best to keep you safe. So I think I continue to want to say that and believe in it, and that's what we'll do.
Does Folt have a response to those who criticize campus police for allowing protesters to topple Silent Sam?
I know the campus police. I see them all the time. I think that we have to be very mindful that they put themselves out in the front line every single day, and I have immense respect for them. They're highly trained and very professional. I'll also tell you, you probably know this, but the police are the first ones to want to do a postmortem after every single event. So they don't sit and go, we did that, we're on to the next thing. They are also questioning and evaluating their own performance, and we're all completely willing to work with the Board of Governors or others who want to really ask questions about that. But I have a lot of confidence in them, and I turn to them again, and I particularly have confidence in their absolute quest to do things in the best possible way and their commitment to our community.
Only one member of the UNC Board of Governors voted against the resolution asking for a November 15th report. In a video, former Republican State Senator Tom Goolsbee outlined his concerns.
I appreciate the commitment of the Board of Governors to obey the Monument Protection Act, but cannot support the motion as it is written. The time frame is far too long, especially in light of the violence, the ongoing threats, and the continuing danger to our campuses. Now, the lack of law enforcement strategy, apparent training, and support on the UNC Chapel Hill campus continues to disturb me. I appreciate the chairman's appointment of two of our governors, one a former North Carolina sheriff, that is Philip Byers, and also Dr. Bob Rucho, who I served with in the Senate. They're going to head a task force to investigate the rioting, property destruction, and the violence on the Chapel Hill campus, as well as the police action, or more appropriately, the police inaction on August 20. An outside law enforcement expert will be retained before the end of this week to investigate this entire sordid matter. Now, state law allows 90 days from the date the statue was torn down for its reinstallation. However, violent outside groups such as Antifa, who's been identified, came on our campus to riot, destroy property, and cause mayhem. And they will not wait around while the UNC Board of Trustees figures out what happened and prepares a written report. Immediate action on our part is necessitated and required.
That's Tom Goolsbee of the UNC Board of Governors. He's just one of the policymakers responding to the ongoing concerns about the future of UNC Chapel Hill's Silent Sam statue. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Well, it is making headlines again. We're talking about a $57.8 million discretionary fund created by Governor Roy Cooper and attached to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline Project in eastern North Carolina. Carolina Journal is reporting that state lawmakers have now created a special group to probe the who, what, where, when, and why of this fund. It is a fund that some say shows Governor Cooper overstepping into fiscal matters that are really the purview of the General Assembly. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He's been following this story closely for a number of months now and joins us with the latest. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, remind us of the details of how this fund came about.
The Atlantic Coast Pipeline is a natural gas pipeline that's going to deliver gas from fracked fields in West Virginia, go through Virginia, and then spur off into North Carolina. It's going to have one terminal point around the Hampton Roads area of Virginia, and then another one in Robeson County. And the pipeline itself was supposed to deliver this natural gas and can do so in a way in a higher volume than your typical gas lines. At least that's the plan. And the during the course of approval of this, somehow or another, the Cooper administration got involved in trying to cut a separate deal with the utilities that are building and will operate the pipeline to provide some additional money for North Carolina over and above the amount of money that these utilities are paying for any sort of environmental impacts that the pipeline will have during the process of construction or operation.
This fund has raised a lot of eyebrows among members of the General Assembly and other folks outside right. of government as well. Why?
The problem with the fund is that this $57.8 million amount, which seems to have been somewhat arbitrary in the amount of money that was included, is something that was negotiated outside the normal boundaries of a fund, a mitigation fund, as they're called, with private companies to handle environmental concerns. Typical process is there may be some sort of negotiation that takes place that involves officials from an administration, but at some point the General Assembly gets involved in it because the North Carolina Constitution gives only the legislative branch the ability to appropriate funds. Now, in some cases, such as the tobacco settlement, for instance, which happened, I guess, now a couple of decades ago, the negotiations were taking place all outside the General Assembly. The General Assembly just kind of signed off on it and said, yeah, we're okay with it. But in this case, the General Assembly was not involved at all until Governor Cooper's Department of Environmental Quality announced it. And it sort of caught everybody off guard. And the General Assembly has been really trying to get to the bottom of this ever since.
Would the governor himself control this fund?
Yes. The governor would control the fund, or the governor and whoever he designates to administer the fund would control the fund. He has said that the fund was going to be spent for environmental mitigation purposes and economic development projects mainly. But the problem, of course, here is the General Assembly has absolutely zero role in figuring out where this money is going to go. And that's a constitutional issue that people on a lot of sides of the political spectrum have said is a real problem.
Which leads us to the latest development at the General Assembly. They have actually created a special subcommittee to take a closer look at all of this.
Right. This is through the Joint Legislative Commission, Committee on Government Operations. And so this is a committee that looks at it's sort of an investigatory committee, and it reviews how different state agencies operate. And the committee will be a member of mostly, I believe, senators, if I'm not mistaken, who will look at who have subpoena power. They'll have the power to demand documents. They'll have the power to compel testimony. They're going to figure out exactly how this all unfolded, who was involved, who basically set this up, who started it, who came up with the number 57.8 million, and why this was done outside the normal process, because the environmental quality officials have already said that they arranged for $6 million from the utilities to handle wildlife relocation and other, wetlands restoration, the sorts of things like that that take place when you dig a major pipeline, most of which is going to go along existing right-of-way. So it's not as if there's a lot of additional damage that was going to be caused by this to begin with. So they really want to get to the bottom of this, and they figured the only way they were going to do that, since the Cooper administration has not been forthcoming with either General Assembly or media about delivering any documents that were worthwhile, they said, okay, we've got to actually appoint a special committee and give it subpoena powers and other sorts of investigatory powers that you wouldn't normally find in a legislative committee.
Rick, do we even know if this $57.8 million has been handed over and by whom and where it exists and a bank account somewhere?
We're not sure. We probably think not, because what information we get from the administration talks about how the money, the delivery of the money being threatened, but they won't actually say that none of it has changed hands yet. So they keep giving very, very vague and obscure sorts of protests against this investigation by the General Assembly, but they really haven't said directly where the money's going to go. Where is it going to sit? I mean, the state treasurer has said as much. I don't know where it's going to go. And then who would spend it? Who would be authorized to spend it?
Okay, so call me naive, but somebody's got to know whether it's been paid or not been paid and where it is or isn't. I mean, how is it possible that the Cooper administration could simply refuse to say?
Well, until somebody actually has somebody sworn under oath with threatening them with going to the pokey unless they tell the truth, then there really isn't any way that they can be compelled to do that. Because side issue, but this is one of the issues with North Carolina's open records and public meetings laws, is that essentially if a state agency, even if the General Assembly requests the state agency deliver some records, that there's no way of recourse of getting those records if the agency decides not to comply without filing a lawsuit, or in this case, without having someone under oath saying that they have the records or don't have the records.
So in this case, if it goes to that extent, then you would have the legislative branch essentially suing the executive branch to, say, turn over the information?
We've never seen that before in the history. we have one branch of government suing right. the other.
The updated civics course.
That's
here.
Right. Yeah. And that's one thing that outgoing Senator Tommy Tucker brought up in the hearing, in the committee hearing, was that people are getting tired of these lawsuits. But again, sometimes it seems to be essential. And because we've had a number of different separation of powers disputes between the governor, going back to Pat McCrory and the General Assembly, then it's not unusual that this could rise to that level as well.
As it relates to this new naming of this subcommittee to look into all of this, has the governor or his administration responded specifically to this?
They haven't exactly called it a witch hunt, but they've come pretty close to it. The governor hasn't quite gone to Twitter and started emulating President Trump yet, but it's almost getting to that point. But they have been very dismissive of it. They've just said, this is unnecessary. This is something that we have the right to do. And you are preventing environmental protection from taking place by doing this right now. You are interfering with the environment. You're killing children. I mean, that kind of rhetoric coming from the governor's office about this, because they don't want this stepped on. And of course, this has implications for a couple of other funds that are currently in litigation. One of them involving
legal settlements.
One involving Volkswagen and some Clean Air Act violations. And then also there's another one going on now with New Hanover County that's taking place with does the governor have control over Smithfield funds for hog waste resolution that goes back to Governor Easley?
This is another one that's going to get very, very interesting, and Carolina Journal will be following this story every step of the way. We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.